Hi, everybody. My name is Doug Rowell, and I am a grateful alcoholic. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if that sounds peculiar to you, it's because you're new. I've been here a while, and actually, since my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on September 26, 1986, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink of alcohol or any mind-altering chemical. But necessary or not, I drank on the way home from that meeting. I heard some stuff I understood, but I didn't get the not necessary to drink part. So I ended up coming back, but I actually do have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is June 7th, 1987, and my home group is the Winner's Attitude Adjustment Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meets every day of the year at 7 a.m. at the First Presbyterian Church of North Hollywood, and my sponsor is Dick Martin in Bellevue, Nebraska, and he would be okay with my breaking his anonymity, but I actually shouldn't have. I say that because there are some people that say that's all you need. If you have a home group, a sobriety date, and a sponsor, that's all you need. And I don't necessarily go along with that. Big Book would be pretty good, for instance. you might want to get a 12 and 12 in a meeting directory. I don't know. But, you know, we say things like, we make statements, you know, and somebody says, that's not true. Oh, okay. Lisa, thank you for your talk. I'm always impressed when people get up here and they're like, uncomfortable getting up here, and it's because you're honest, you know. Because I'm not like that. I wanted to be the speaker at the first meeting I ever went to, you know. But I was a little drunk that night, so. You almost, here's something you almost never hear in AA. Hey, let's see if we can get the drunk guy to talk, you know. I'm having fun here. I want to thank Paul for calling and asking me to come and do this. When I was new, I used to collect speaker tapes, and I would go to a Tuesday night meeting. There was a guy named Bernie at this Tuesday night meeting. Some people here, there's a lot of people here that I know. There are a lot of people here that knew me when I didn't own a shirt with sleeves in it, and but there was this guy named Bernie who taped speakers and booked speakers for about four or five different meetings around the San Fernando Valley. And every Tuesday I would go and I'd buy four tapes from him. And one of the tapes that I had, one of the first times I ever heard Chuck C was from Mad Dog Days. That's the first time I ever heard of this convention. And I've never been here before, so I was kind of excited when Paul called and asked me to come. I'm still excited about being. I love doing this. You know, I think that talking at an AA meeting is the most fun you can have with your pants on. You know, I'm so grateful that I get asked to do this kind of thing. The first meeting that I went to, I didn't expect to stay. I didn't go to join up. I went to see what it was about. I had a couple of friends who had gotten sober, and they were sober 6 or 8 months, a man and a woman. They weren't a couple. They were individuals that I drank and used with, and we partied a lot, and at least one of them really, really needed to stop drinking. I was really happy when she stopped. The other guy, I think he could have drank a couple more months, but you notice things. If somebody's working any kind of at least a little bit of a program, you can see something that's going on in their life. And I noticed that both of them would like show up when they said they were going to be somewhere, when they said they were going to be there, where they said they were going to be, they dressed appropriately and speaking in whole sentences. And I was impressed with that. And so I thought, I'm only going to go to an AA meeting, see what's going on, and, you know, in case I ever need it, you know. And so I went to the, somebody told me there's a big meeting at Valley Presbyterian Hospital in Van Nuys on Friday nights. It's a speaker meeting. There's a lot of people there. They'll leave you alone. So that sounded good to me. It was a lie. It's a lie. You know, people don't leave you alone in AA meetings. Like, I guess they meant, you know, if you go to a meeting with 10 or 12 people, there'll be more focus on you. But, you know, everybody was coming. I just kind of leaned against the wall. Like, see, people are doing that tonight. You know, that's what I was doing. I was leaning against the wall. Not that there's anything wrong. I don't know why you're doing it. Maybe you got the newcomer catch your commitment or something. But I was trying to isolate myself. I was like, okay, yeah. All right, go on with your little meeting. You know, but people won't leave you alone. Hey, you're new. Welcome. Hey, you ever been here before? No, I haven't. You're from out of town? No, I live around here. First time in it? Yeah, yes, my first time. We'll keep coming back. Yeah, we'll see. You know. There's some chairs over here if you want to sit down. There's some empty chairs, right? You know, I'm a figure outer, and I'm watching people like come in and set down a jacket, keys, purse. No keys, no purse, no jacket. That's available seat. I can sit there. I get it. Actually, I may not be able to stay long, and I don't want to, you know, if I have to leave, I don't want to, you know, cause a scene, get up, excuse me, and everything. So I'm just stay back here, okay? You know, and I had to explain this to about four or five people who would come up and, you know, try to get me to sit down. And I'm like, I'm not here to join up. I told one lady, I didn't come to join up, okay? I don't even care about stopping drinking. I like drinking. I drank on the way here. And I expect to drink on the way home. I'm just sort of checking it out. I'm auditing the class. Can you dig it? You know, I'm just... So just, you know, go on with your little meeting. You know, I'm not a joiner. I don't, you know, I see the rest of you are like, oh, hug, kiss, isn't it good we're not drinking? I'm really, I'm not a joiner. I never have been. I'm kind of a loner. You know, I'm kind of a outlaw. You know, I'm a desperado, if you must know. You know, I'm a misfit, lady. I never fit any place in my life. I didn't fit in school. I didn't fit in the workplace. I didn't even fit in my own damn family, okay? So just go on with your little meeting. You know, surely not going to fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, isn't it good we're not drinking? Just, I'll be fine, okay? You know, I'll just stand back here. Boy, you know what? I don't want to say I got sober 20 years too early, but now they have Bluetooth. And like... I mean, nothing. There's nothing really that says I'm very important. I may get a call and have to leave, like a piece of electronic flashing jewelry, you know, like. When I got sober, they didn't even have cell phones. I mean, they had mobile phones, but they were big. They were in briefcases, and only, you know, only rich people had them, and. They had pagers. People had pagers when I got sober, but I didn't have a pager. Nobody wanted to contact me. I didn't have a pager. But I had gone to a Goodwill store and got a garage door opener. It had a belt clip on it. And I just have that on. So if I got tired of talking to you or my drink alarm went off or something, I can go. I got to get this. So, of course, I had that on, you know. What's that? Looks like my garage door opener. Yeah, it's a combination garage door, pager, TV remote. It's like the latest thing, you know. And so they started the meeting, and I was standing at the back, and there was another guy There was like double doors like this, and I was on one side of the double doors, and another guy was on standing on the other side of the double doors. And we were like the cool section, you know? We were so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. We were like... And so I don't remember very much about the meeting. And the funny thing is, I know it was a speaker meeting because I know the meeting, but I can't tell you if the speaker was a man or a woman. I didn't pay attention to the speaker somehow. There were things, I noticed that people were nice to me. People came up and said, keep coming back. Yeah, I get that a lot, you know. yeah, we'll see. And there was a lot of laughing and hugging and two different kinds of coffee. I remember that. And a table with a lot of literature on it. And then they had a birthday that night. I didn't know what it, I'd never heard of AA birthdays, but the secretary said, we have a birthday tonight. I'm thinking, what's birthday in AA speak? You know, he said, we have a birthday for Ruth for 18 years. And I said, oh, a birthday, a birthday. Okay. So I'm looking around for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny honey. Where's Ruth? And and Ruth gets up, and she's 50 if she's a day, you know. And the first thing I thought was, God damn, if she's 18, she should stop drinking, you know. But she didn't look beat up. I mean, she looked whipped for a teenager, but she looked good. She, you know, she was coiffed and dressed up and made up, and I thought, okay, she isn't 18. This is AA. They don't drink here. She's sober 18 years. That's what it is. They're celebrating. It's probably a national record. No wonder everybody's so excited about it. And so I tell you, I'm a figure outer. So Ruth comes up, and these three younger girls come out with this cake and candles blazing. Everybody starts singing, like 200 people singing Happy Birthday in four different keys, top of their lungs simultaneously. And I'm like, ah, you know. And many of them were not even committed to the key they started in. And, you know, I have a musical background. I'm just a little bit put off by this. And and nobody seemed to mind. Except me, and they had a piano. If anybody remembers that meeting at Valley Presbyterian Hospital, they had a piano up on stage with a sheet over it. It's like somebody in 200 people must be able to play Happy Birthday. I could do it. I thought, I'm going to go, I'll rip that cover. Just a minute, people. Here I come to save the day, you know, and bum, 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 Happy Birthday. But I already told a lot of people I wasn't staying, so... So I got no lines. I'm just, okay, it's a short song. I can handle it. And then Ruth gets up and says, my name is Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic. And everybody says, hi, Ruth! Oh, God, I was so embarrassed for you. It's like this is some level of lameness I never imagined existed. But now I'm entertained now. I couldn't leave no matter what. And Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And people were impressed with this, and I'm in the back going, You're a little slow, ain't you, Ruth? You know. You are not the sharpest pencil in the box, honey. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get this deal if I want it, but I know it's not going to take every day for 18 years. I'm sorry, you can graduate medical school in 7 years, you know. You work, you know, but I mean, I had this picture of Ruth going home every night and, walking in, her husband, how was the meeting, honey? I'm going to have to go back tomorrow. and so... so So I'm just wildly entertained now. And then I remember the secretary held up this book, this book, and she said, this is, among a bunch of other things and readings and everything, she said, this is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the basic text of the program. It's the only authority on AA. I said, oh, that's interesting. And she said, if you're new, don't leave without this book. And I said, they had a bunch of them on a table. I said, okay, I'll steal the book then. I figured I could get the book, look at it like, oh, hey, wow, this is great. This is really going to help with my sorority, you know, and just walk right out the door with the book. And they'd say, well, let him go. I had a feeling, and I still think that would have happened. But then, well, she screwed it up. She said, if you're new tonight and you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We know what that's like. We want you to have this book. We'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week till you get back on your feet. So, now if I steal the book, they're going to think I'm homeless, you know? I'm not on my feet, you know? So I had to wait till the end of the meeting, and then I went up to the secretary, and I said, hey, can I buy one of those books? And she said, sure, the big book? And I said, yeah, the big book. I seemed bigger. how much is it? She said, it's $4.65. Do you have it? Do I have $4.65 for a hardcover book? Yeah, I think I can handle that. How about here's a $5. Keep the change. They said, I'll get you change. No, use that to, you know, help a drunk or something. I'm on my feet, you know, so... took the book home, and I got home with this book. So I thought, I'm going to, you know, look through, see what's going on with this book. It's the only authority. So I poured a shot of whiskey, and I sat down with this book to read, not read it, not like study read it, but, you know, to skim it, to see what's going on. I have the ability to look at the title of a chapter, any book, and know everything that's in the chapter. It's a, you know, it's a gift that I have, and so I'm looking through this, like, some of it I didn't have to read, like a doctor's opinion. I've had doctor's opinions. They'll say things like to me, like, boy, you ought to not drink so much, you know? So, okay, so next, chapter one, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter two, there's a solution. I know what there's a solution is. It's a sales pitch. I mean, I was raised on TV. I see a sales pitch a mile away. Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. All right, next, chapter three, more about alcoholism. That sounded just spellbinding, and so I have to get around to that sometime. Chapter four, we agnostics. We agnostics. Okay, I didn't expect to find a chapter called We Agnostics. I was totally blown away. How did this get in here? Because I'll tell you, the first meeting I went to, there were some things I liked. I liked the hugging and laughing a lot, and the people. I believed. Now, everybody, this doesn't happen to everybody, but I believed that you people drank like I did, and I believed that you didn't drink anymore. And I have a lot of people in AA either don't believe you drank like I did, or they don't believe you can entirely stop. But I bought both of those. There was some stuff there I didn't like the God talk. You know, I wasn't crazy about the not drinking for extended periods. I thought that was excessive. But the God stuff really blew me away. I didn't expect it. I thought that AA, nobody ever told me this, but I thought that AA was the secular way to get sober without God. See, my grandmother was a Pentecostal minister. Evidently, she was an alcoholic too, but not. But before I had any memory of her, she got sober when I was about 5 or 6 and she found Jesus and became a Pentecostal minister. She had a Skid Row mission in San Pedro, on Beacon Street in San Pedro. And the White Dove Pentecostal Mission, and she would bring wharf rats and winos in, you know, and bring them to Jesus. And part of the side benefits of having your soul saved is that you stop drinking. And so I knew that you could get sober on soup and Jesus. You know, I had seen it done. So, but it, I don't know, it just never seemed worth it to me. And I came to AA expecting this to be the secular way to get sober like the smart people do it. And seemed like everybody was talking about power greater than yourself and my higher power and humbly asked him with a capital H, hello, admitted to God and God, everybody's talking about God. And I thought, geez, the last house on the block and it's Sunday school. You know, so I was put off by that. But now I'm reading this big book, The Only Authority on AA, the secretary had said, and here's a chapter called We Agnostics. Okay, here it is. This is how the smart people do it without God. So I poured a shot of whiskey and I read chapter 4, beginning to end. And I finished with it and I thought, okay, I missed the whole smart people stay sober without God thing. So I poured another shot and I read it again. And at this time, I'm going, focus. Because it's not only a trick title, but there's a lot of, like, scientific stuff in there. And I mean, the book, I didn't know this at the time, but the book was written in 1938, published in 39. And there's talk about the Wright brothers in there, extensive talk about the Wright brothers and Adams and the prosaic steel girder. And if you think about it, the Wright brothers, it was about the same amount of time from the Wright brothers' first flight to the publishing of the big book as it has been since the blowing up of the Challenger to right now. You know, so people were aware of that, that first flight at the time. And so this was pretty scientific stuff. And so it threw me off. Like it was scientific, and then it was spiritual. And I read it about 6 times at night. Shot of whiskey, read chapter 4. Shot of whiskey, read chapter 4. And finally, I realized it's never going to change. You know, like I told you, I'm a figure-outer, you know. And so I don't know if it was the whiskey slowing down my mind to the point where I could focus on the black part of just the bombardment of the same piece of literature over and over. But some of the stuff that's actually in chapter 4 finally stuck with me. One sentence in particular. It's incredibly significant, and yet it's stated so subtly that I think most of us kind of skip over it. I certainly did at first. When it finally caught my eye, it says, "We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him." We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. Now, it sounds, yeah, that seems right. You know, if there's a power that created the universe, it certainly wouldn't be bound by the kind of ego that would require us to, you know, bow and scrape and do. And yet, I never heard it any place before I read it in the big book. They certainly never suggested that at my grandmother's Pentecostal mission. If anything, they said just the opposite. It seemed like they said, for one thing, they said my name in less than a syllable. Used to irritate. You know, the... We're very sure that God makes hard times on those who seek him. Boy, you know God will not even hear your prayers unless you are baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist. I'm talking about total submission, son. That's why we got this tank of water for Christ up here. Come on up here, boy. We will soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Amen. Somebody get the boy a towel.
And, I'm like 14 years old going, they're going to drown me. She told them I touched myself. They're going to send my ass to Jesus tonight. And, I got brand new jeans on, you know, they're shrink to fit, you know, I couldn't ride my bike home, but next week I'll wear something more water soluble. How about that? You know, I mean, okay, If it was just the Pentecostals, you go, okay, Pentecostals are over the top. But it seemed to me every sect of every religion on the planet had some weird stuff they had to do. My girlfriend was Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons, so she could find out how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers were required to cleanse her soul of the various sins. If you're Catholic, you know when I say various sins, they got them categorized, don't they? They got venial and menial and cardinal and mortal, and some of them you don't even have to do them if you think about them. Express way to hell, buddy. So, but she would do all, her whole family would do all this stuff, and they'd cleanse their souls. I went to church with them one time. I thought they were drinking the holy water when they went. I thought they were going like this. I almost did that, almost got my arm broken. You know, and I said, okay. And we sat down, and I didn't understand. It seemed like they were talking a foreign language, which I found out later they were. That we were sitting there for a while. Then I thought they were getting up, so I got up, and then I see I'm the only one standing. Everybody else is kneeling, so I kneeled. They sat. I'm like, I feel like the middle cylinder on a three-cylinder engine. Okay, I'm not going back there anymore, you know. I don't know their deal, you know. It seemed like they loved doing all that stuff, and they would do it and cleanse their souls, and they still couldn't talk to God. They talked to God's mom. Hello, Mrs. God, it's Julie. You know, don't wake him. Just tell him I love him. Okay, bye. I guess that's what it was. My friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew, and he and his brother had to wear spit curls to school, so I didn't really want anything to do with that. I'd go over to their house because it was a warm, safe place to go. You felt comfortable walking in there, like you're going to be okay here, you know. And Mrs. Rothberg would act like she'd been waiting for you all week. Doug, welcome to our home. It's an honor to have you. would you like to join us in some wine and challah? some what? Would you like to join us in some wine and challah? No, I'm not much of a pastry eater, you know. But I will have some wine. And then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. I just said, okay, I'm done. Take all the religions of the world, put them on that side of the line. I'll stay over here and make fun of them. So that's the guy that came to AA. And I was really irritated by hearing all this God stuff. But then I'm reading in the book, we found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. I didn't have an epiphany when I came to understand that. But what it did was open up the door for me. If an epiphany comes along, I'm available maybe, you know. It goes on, the book goes on to say, you don't have to accept anybody's concept of God. A lot of times people, especially new people who are overly educated, will say the book is poorly written, you know, the language is archaic. That is one of the most efficient uses of the English language. You don't have to accept anybody's concept of God. Find one that you're comfortable with, and that seems to be fine with the power that created the universe. You know, that kind of takes the pressure off, doesn't it? You know? And another thing, I love this chapter. I heard somebody say one time that chapter 4, We Agnostics, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is the most important piece of spiritual literature of the English language in the 20th century. That is an incredible endorsement. I don't know if it's true, because I don't know enough about spiritual literature. It is for me. I mean, it's absolutely true for me. There's another great sentence in that says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. That's only true for alcoholics. It turns out that normies think that's kind of a no-brainer, you know. And you can test this one. Get yourself a clipboard and stand in front of the Walmart sometime to stop people when they're coming out. Excuse me, I'm taking a survey. Would you rather die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life? Come on, I need an answer, yes or no. You know, it's like, they'll go. Am I on candid camera? You know, most of the, I'll take that. I'll take the spiritual deal. You know, without even saying, what religion are you proselytizing for? You know, that it's just like something about a really inquisitive normie might say something like, okay, when you say alcoholic death, you're talking about where you puff up and turn yellow and choke to death on your own vomit and bile. Yeah. You make it sound bad. Yeah. If you ever do the Walmart test, you know if you found one of us, because it's like, hello, I'm taking a survey, alcoholic death or spiritual life, and you get this. You going to be here tomorrow? I love us. I told everybody I could find that I wasn't going to fit here when I got here. And it's the only place I ever fit in my life. That's why I love it. That's why I'm still sober. I went back to AA. And I started liking it. Every time I went to a meeting, I started going pretty regular. And then my first 8 months in AA, I got to tell you, I didn't have a home group. I went to meetings all over San Fernando Valley and Hollywood and West Hollywood. And I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment. I didn't believe in God, and I was drinking every day. Okay, but aside from that, I had a pretty good program, which was keep coming back. That was my whole program. They said, keep coming back. Okay, see you tomorrow. You know, at some point, I started. I mean, there's anybody with less than 30 days, Doug, alcoholic. Anybody who, any new friends with us with less than 30 days of sobriety, Doug, alcoholic. Anybody in their first 30, Doug, alcoholic. You know, after about 3 months of this, I just got tired of it. And one day I was at the San Fernando group, and they said, anybody with less than 30 days? And I started to raise my hand, and a voice in my head says, amen. You're drinking every day. It's going to be a long time before you have 30 days. Screw them. None of their business. That's right. That's none of their damn business. I ain't raising my hand. So I sat there, and somebody, this gal down the table, one of those table meetings, you know, and this gal down the table mistook my arrogance for serenity or something, and she said to her friend, Doug's got 30 days. Because I didn't raise my hand. I get it. I see what's going on. And I didn't want to make her look bad. She was on my 13-step list. And, I wasn't doing any 13-stepping, but I had a list. And the funny thing is, after I got sober, I kept adding to this. I didn't want to, you know, go on a date and take the girl home. And if I kissed her goodnight and she smells whiskey on me, she's going to rat me out to the group and I won't be able to go to AA anymore, you know. So, but I had this list. And the funny thing is, when I finally did get sober, I was sober 3 weeks, 21 days. And this gal with 2.5 years, who was also on my list, she was right at the top of the list, actually, started 13-step me, and it was so enjoyable. We went out again, and then we started going out. Then she moved into my house, and then we lived together for 9 years, and then we got married, and we were married for 6 years. We were together the whole first 15 years of my sobriety, you know, and then we got divorced a few years ago. And the funny thing is, what happens with two people who are working a spiritual program, a lot of times, I mean, there wasn't any resentment. We just kind of outgrew each other. We, you know, we were like brother and sister, and we decided we didn't want to be married anymore, and we got divorced, and there was no fighting, there was no yelling, there was no cheating, there was no stealing. It was all very, very comfortable, and we're still friends today. And Randy, I'm extremely grateful to Randy because she taught me how to ask questions. I'm not a question asker by nature. Something in my head says, if you ask that question, they're going to think you don't know the answer, you know? Which, I mean, yeah, but why would you ask the question? But I don't want people to think I'm ignorant. So what I like to do is, like, you know, wait around. If I want to know, you know, what's the capital of Peru, and I think Lisa knows, I'll get the conversation over to Peru, you know, and then when somebody says, what the hell is the capital of Peru? And Lisa says, Lima, I go, yeah, that's right. You know, so, but Randy taught me how to ask questions. We were in bed one night, and don't get ahead of me. I have my leg over on her side of the bed, okay? And so she was assertive, and she grabbed my leg and she threw it like a log. And hey, get over on your own side of the bed. She said, God, you sleep like Jim Parks. So now I'm laying there on my own side of the bed, thinking, who the hell is Jim Parks? And why would she say that? I know she slept with a lot of people before I came along. I slept with a lot of people too, but I don't bring them into our bedroom. I don't bring them into the bed and say, you sleep like them. I'm getting this resentment. And I want to say, hey, who the hell is Jim Parks? And she's a voracious reader. Randy reads everything. So if I say, who's Jim Parks? She might say, oh, I guess you're not familiar with For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know. Oh, you never read Peyton Place, I guess, huh? You know, I mean, but I'm laying there working on this resentment, and I haven't said anything, and I know if I don't say something, I'm going to be wearing this thing. It's going to get heavier as the days go by, and eventually she's going to say something like, did you mean to leave your boots in the dining room, you know? And I'm going to say, hey, boots my ass. Hey, boot down on this, bitch. Who's Jim Parks? You know what I'm saying? So, I can clear this up right now with a question. So I said, I'm sorry, honey, am I supposed to know who Jim Parks is and how he sleeps? And she starts cackling. You know Jim across the street? I said, what? Jim across the street. Yeah, you know how he puts his truck so you can't park in front of him or behind him without blocking a driveway? You sleep like Jim Parks. So. So anyway, back to the meeting at San Fernando Group. This gal was on my 13-step list, and she thought I had 30 days, and I don't want to make her look bad, so I took a chip. I took a 30-day chip. And everybody was thrilled about it. Yay, Doug! And I'm thinking, how do these people know my name? You know, Doug Alcoholic. So it made him so happy that I went over to this place called Chandler Lodge in North Hollywood the next day, and I took a chip over there. Boy, they went crazy. They were like, yeah! You know, so I took chips all over the San Fernando Valley and Hollywood, West Hollywood, and went up to Ventura at a meeting I'd never been to, took a 60-day chip up there, and I was at a noon meeting at the Valley Club one time in Reseda, and I was at the coffee pot, and some gal said to her friend, she wasn't talking to me, she said to her friend, my sponsor says I can't stay sober. I mean, I can't have sex till I'm sober 6 months. So I took a 6-month chip over there. It's like, I don't know, you know. What if I get lucky? And then she wants to know, you know, how long are you sober? 6 months, baby, right here, you know. It's like, yeah, buddy. So, the fact is, I couldn't have scored in a women's prison with a pocket full of pardons, you know, but just in case. So what ended up happening, by the time I got sober, I had 4 different sobriety dates at 4 different groups, and it gets hard to keep track of them, and some people go to, like, the same person goes to that meeting, and it's just a lot of trouble. One time I came home from a meeting. I used to come home from evening meetings with a bottle of whiskey, and I'd lay on the floor and turn on the TV and drink and think about what I heard at the meeting, and usually I'd pass out. And one time I did that after I'd been going to AA for 8 months, passed out, woke up about 3 in the morning, my bottle's about half full, turned off the TV, got my bottle, crawled on my hands and knees through my living room, through the hallway, into the bedroom to go to bed, which I know some people call it pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. If you're doing it, you just call it going to bed. seemed like, actually, it seemed smart to me. I remember the first time I said, hey, you can't fall off the floor. And I crawled into my bedroom and I stood up to get undressed and I fell. I lost my balance and fell. I won't ask for a show of hands. I know some people understand what I'm talking about. And I spilled this whiskey all over the bed and I picked up the bottle. There was a little bit left, but most of it was in the bedspread. So I set the bottle in a safe place and I grabbed this bedspread and I started sucking whiskey out of it. And a voice in my head said, hey man, that ain't right. Hey man, you thirsty? There's whiskey in the bottle. No, I'm not thirsty so much as frugal. I'll waste my life, but I don't waste whiskey. I don't let whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight. But look at what I was doing, and I got no excuse for it. I've been going to AA for 8 months, and I haven't learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. And I said, maybe I'm a hopeless loser. I heard people talking about hopeless losers. They'd say, I heard people say that you go to Alano clubs all over the country, and there's people around there that have been coming for 20 years and have never seen 60 days of continuous sobriety. Maybe I'm somebody like that. It's not a good thing to think about yourself. And I had no idea what to do about it. And tell you what, no idea is a real good place to be. I was out of ideas, man. And I did a dumb thing. I said, God, if you're there, please help me. I asked a God that I absolutely did not believe in, not for 1 second, but I was out of ideas, and I said, God, if you're there, please help me. And I went to bed, and I went to sleep, and over the next couple of weeks, interesting things happened every single day. Next day, I went to my favorite liquor store. There's somebody from AA behind the counter. What are you doing here, man? What are you doing here? I just came to get some cigarettes, you know, and I went somewhere else to get my bottle, and I'm in a restaurant, and I start to order a margarita. The waitress is somebody I know from AA. I'm in the Vons Market, start in the liquor department, reach up for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time. Keep it simple. You know, beautiful damn life, isn't it? And every day, some weird little thing like this would happen. And eventually, after a couple of weeks, after 14 days of this, I was on the way to work, 7 or 6 a.m., and I just killed a half pint of Bushmills. And I don't keep empty bottles in the car. They're illegal and useless. And I tossed it out the window. Just as I let it go, a guy from AA is driving towards me, and he sees me and waves, and the bottle goes flying out the window, ding, 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 you know, and I thought, where the hell are these people coming from? It's like, there's all these sober alcoholics. It's like the stupid miracles that they talk about in meetings. And the moment I thought the word miracle was like I could hear God laughing. Miracles. And I pulled the car over to the side of the road, and I just sat there, and I thought about it. I remembered that I'd been on my knees and said, God, if you're there, please help me. And then after that, on a daily basis, these weird little pain in the ass God jokes were happening, which I've come to believe are miracles. I don't know if those are miracles or coincidences, but if there's a miracle involved, maybe it was just that I recognized it after a while. And I realized something was happening here, and I had asked for help, and I had gotten help, and I was aware of it. And I sat there that moment, and I came to believe. Sat there in that car that morning, and I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And it was the beginning of my sobriety and the beginning of my hearing the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I say the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean the thing, the rhythm and the harmony and the melody that runs through this thing and makes the words make sense. Because a lot of the words don't make sense on their own. Give it away to keep it, surrender to win. And Big Book says on one page, with regard to alcohol, we're placed in a position of neutrality. And on the next page, it says, when we're tempted by alcohol, we recoil as from a hot flame. You know, oh, that's the same paragraph, by the way. You know, so it's just, I don't know, is it a hot flame or am I neutral to it? But once you start to hear the music, the words start to make sense. And that's it's hard to explain. When I actually had 30 days,
It fell on a Thursday, and I went over to the Burbank group, which was cake and chip night at the Burbank group on Thursday night. And I went there, and I could hardly wait to take my first honest 30-day chip. I had enough chips to open a casino by then, but this was an honest 30-day chip. And so I went there, and they said, anybody with 30 days? And I got up, and I took my first honest 30-day chip. And I didn't care if anybody believed me, because my new friend God knew I had 30 days, and I knew I had 30 days. It was an honest chip. And I took it, and I said, I'm Doug. I'm an alcoholic. And when they said, hi, Doug, I felt like a member. You know, I understand now that I was a member before, even when I was drinking. If I ever had an honest desire to stop drinking, I was a member. But when I took that 30-day chip and they said, hi, Doug, I felt like a member. And I just watched people take 60 and 90-day chips and 6-month chips and 9-month chips and a 3-year cake and a 7-year cake and a 19-year cake. And I was just high on being sober. You know what I'm talking about, you know, if you felt that before. And I was just, I was elated. And they had a coffee break. I went to get my coffee, and a guy stopped me, and he said, congratulations on that 30 days. I said, thanks. And he said, you know what the secret is? I said, I don't drink, I guess, you know. And he said, no, that's not it. We don't drink here, but that's not the deal. The deal here is hang on. You think you can do that? And I said, well, that's what I've been doing. And he said, exactly. Keep doing that. And he walked away. And I'm, okay, you get 30 days. They tell you the secret. Now I'm looking for some newcomer to screw up, I mean, to share my experience, strength, and hope with. And before I could find a victim, there was a guy at Burbank Group, and I know some people in here knew him, named Jim Baker. He just died a couple of months ago, and he was very active in AA, and he was a Southern-born, glad-handing, back-slapping alcoholic, you know, and he came up and he said, son, congratulations on that 30 days. I said, thanks, and he said, you know what the secret is? I said, yep, hang on. And he said, no, let go. Okay. All right. The old timers are diametrically opposed to what the secret is, so, but I get it. I'm hearing the music, so the words aren't making me crazy anymore. Clearly, Hank, the guy that told me, hang on, is talking about stay close. You know, keep coming back. Stay in the middle of the herd, they used to tell me. Stay in the middle of the herd. Don't get around the perimeters and get picked off by predators. That's what hang on is all about. And Jim that told me let go is talking about let go and let God. Surrender. The theme of your convention. We absolutely insist, or rather, what the hell is it? Let go absolutely. Let go absolutely. You know? Surrender. They told me the war is over and you lost. It's like, okay, I get it, you know. Honesty used to make me crazy. Right after I first got sober, and I'd hear him read chapter 5, honesty, 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 honesty. You know, people who don't get sober seem to be constitutionally incapable, and even people with grave emotional and mental disorders can if they have the capacity to be honest, rigorous, honest. You know, it's like, okay, I get it, you know. I don't know if I'm honest enough to stay sober. I'll do the best I can. And, you know what, I'm 20 years sober now, and sometimes I lie. I I only do it when I'm divinely directed. Yeah, you're sober a while. You know when God wants you to fib. You know, I'm getting married next month, and my fiance Ponella. Thank you. My fiance Ponella is very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She couldn't come this weekend because she's got AA commitments in town. It's like, couldn't somebody cover him for you? I don't think so. you know, if I say to her, I mean, if she says to me, baby, does this dress make me look fat? Oh, yeah, go right for rigorous honesty, you know. No, honey, I think it's the Haagen-Dazs, you know. I don't do that. I don't play that, you know. The answer to that question is, you look beautiful in anything or nothing. And
You know, if you're new, think about it. When you know, a rigorous honesty thing is it's good. I'm in the habit of lying to waiters. I automatically lie to waiters. Waiter says to me, "Not, he's just doing his job." Sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner? I lie to him always, automatically. No, thank you. You know, rigorous honesty, boy. You know what? I would. I'd love a cocktail. I like a cocktail instead of dinner. I'd like a double Bushmills meat and a margarita back, and keep them coming. I got a pocket full of plastic, son. We gonna party tonight. You know, but no. Come here. I'm just kidding. Don't do it. I have a disease. I have an illness, boy. It's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy and spiritual bankruptcy. You don't want that in your nice restaurant, do you? You know? You know? Don't ask the guy at table number 7 if he wants a drink, okay? You know? It's like, so, you know, that's what I'm saying. You kind of get a feeling for this. And I'll tell you something. People misquote the book. People with considerable time occasionally will misquote the book. Almost every day, I'll take it back. Every single day in AA, you can hear somebody misquoting the big book. And I doubt that it's ever done on purpose. But I didn't know that when I was newly sober. I thought anybody with over 90 days probably had it memorized. That's what I was. I still wasn't reading it. I'm just not much of a reader, you know, but I was trying to get by without it, and I thought, you know, people quote the book all the time. Sometimes they even give page numbers. I have a very good memory. Eventually, I'll have it all memorized, including page numbers, and people will think I read it all the time, you know. But I didn't know that people misquote it frequently, and so there was a woman that said, she said, "Our book says," so she goes, "Our book says, our drinking was but a symptom of deeper underlying causes and conditions," which it does say. But then she added her own stuff without saying, "And my opinion is." Maybe she thought it came out of the book, but she said, "So, if you don't find your deeper underlying cause and condition, you're going to drink again." Well, the book doesn't say that. It doesn't even suggest it. But I didn't know because I wasn't reading it. So I'm like, what? If I don't find my deeper underlying cause and condition, I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition. I know a lot of people in AA started drinking young. I didn't. I didn't drink till I was 18. I never was interested in drinking. And I never would have, maybe, except my friend Morris, who was like my sexual sponsor, said, "If you want to get this girl's pants, you got to get her drunk." So I stole a quart of Rainier Ale, which was the national beverage of Garden Grove, where I grew up, and I would have been happy to say, "Here, drink this, and let me know when you're ready," you know. But it just, you know, it's just rude. So I drank some, and she drank some, and we passed it back and forth till the quart was gone. And Morris was right. I mean, it turned out the first time I ever got drunk, and the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. And I thought, okay, this works for me. You know, I like the feeling. I like what happened. So I started drinking. I don't know if it was a deeper underlying cause. I don't come from an alcoholic family. My dad was the kind of guy who would buy a six-pack of beer, drink one, put 5 in the fridge, leave them there, forget they're there. You know, I don't understand that kind of drinking. It makes me sick. But my mother might be an alcoholic. We don't know because she won't drink. And you really can't tell. You know, you can't tell. It's like, I asked her one time, "How come you don't drink? Are you an alcoholic?" She goes, "What?" I said, "Why don't you drink? Are you an alcoholic?" She said, "What do you care?" I said, "Well, there's such a thing as a genetic predisposition. Maybe it's your fault I'm a drunk." And she said, "I don't know. Maybe I might be. When I was young, I drank, and every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious, so I quit." I said, "You got to drink through that, Mom. The promised land lies beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious." But I'm preaching to the choir. She didn't have the tenacity to make this thing. But I'm looking back over my life. I'm shining the searchlight over my drinking career. You know, where's my deeper underlying cause? Yeah. Duh. When I was 24 years old, I went to see a show called Hair. It was a a Broadway musical about hippies singing and dancing and sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And they dance and they got nude and it was a spiritual awakening for me. And there was a character named Berger that swung on a rope and screamed rock and roll and spirit changed the audience and offended people. And I said, I could do that. So I called the Aquarius Theater the next day and I said, yeah, I'd like to be in your show. And the guy said, and like today, this couldn't happen. If you did this today, they would say, who is your representation? You know, please have your agent call us and maybe, you know. In 1969, it was just a different world. A street hippie could walk in there and get a job as a singer-dancer, if you could sing and dance. So I said, he said, well, what are you doing Friday at 1 o'clock? I said, you tell me. And he said, okay, you got an audition. What's your name? I told him, and he said, bring some sheet music. Be prepared to sing and dance. Cool. Now I got an audition Friday at 1 o'clock. I don't know how that happened, but I got my sheet music and Friday morning I've got my guitar out. I'm practicing the song I'm going to sing, and I broke a string on the guitar, and yeah, it's hard to explain, but for hippies like it was like, oh, bad karma, man, and so. So I went in my roommate's room to see if he had the string that I needed, a D string that I broke, and right in the middle of his dresser was a little envelope with a D on it. The D string. I'm going, good karma, man. You know. So I picked up the envelope, and underneath the envelope was a little white capsule. And I wonder what this is. Oh, because... you know, we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything, you know, it's an effective test. Forget about motor vehicles and heavy machinery. You know, it's like if you take it, you know exactly what it does. And if somebody dies, don't eat the green shit. You know, but this turned out to be THC, synthetic marijuana, which is a nice little psychedelic. And by the time I got down to the Aquarius Theater, I was floating. I was just like, oh yeah, and my hair was long over, almost down to my waist. You know, it was like. And it swished when I walked, and I had these hip hugger bell bottoms on, like low down hip huggers with bells about that big, foom, 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 and no shirt on. If you're trying to picture it, I was 50 pounds younger, and no shirt, but I had a vest with six layers of foot long red, white, and blue leather fringe. Woo! I was a walking wind chime, I had my walked up to the Aquarius Theater, walked up those steps with my sheet music, and I stood in the back of the auditorium and watched people audition. They were having a lot of auditions that day. These hippies sing and dance, man. They're good. I forgot what I was there for. And somebody said, Doug Rowell. Is Doug Rowell here? Yeah. So I went down. They said, go on up. I went up. I handed my sheet music to the piano player. He opens it up. He looks at it. Big smile. He winks at me. He starts to play. Bump, 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 bump. I said, wow! I went into this James Brown number. I thought I was the godfather of soul, you know. And I'm across the stage and I'm down on one knee. Wow, when I hold you, I thought, wow, wow, wow. And I ended up in bum, 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 wow. They're nudging each other. And one guy says to me, great, man, we love your energy. Can you do something a little mellower so we can get a range, kind of? And I said, yeah, sure. So I went into an a cappella version of Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay. And the piano player picked it up, and we were right in the pocket. Yeah, I made myself cry. And they're nudging each other. I see they love it. And I'm thinking, maybe I won't have to dance, you know, because I'm like, I don't ever dance. I never dance a step. I'm the guy up on the bandstand watching people dance. I know what good dancing looks like when I never tried it. And so he said, great, man, we just got to see a dance. Hit it. So a guy starts playing, and I start, you know. And see my hair coming around. And I see the fringe on this vest is shoo-pow, shoo-pow. And I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance?
Because, you know, alcohol and drugs do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And they hired me. But not for the L.A. show that I thought I was auditioning for. They hired me for the Las Vegas show. And I went to Las Vegas to understudy this role of Berger. And I understudied Berger for about 6 months in Vegas, and then we went on the road, and they gave me the pink contract, the lead contract, playing the role of Berger, the obnoxious speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. And it was a stretch, but I could do it. And and we played all over the United States and Canada, and people would come up on the stage after the show. You were great, man. Here, have some pot, brother. Send some me and Maui Waui, Panama Red, Acapulco Gold. Give us this great dope. Some, hey, man, you like acid? Here, Osley, Purple Haze, Orange Sunshine, Window Pane. Hey, you know, and I was like, some beautiful woman would come up and go, oh, God, I love you. Take me. Okay. You know, so... you know, it's like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and traveling around the country and getting paid for it for 3.5 years. And I look back at that experience, and I realized they used me. You know, you don't realize how much you're being victimized until you get stepped back. And so I called my sponsor, and I said, hey, Jim, I found it. Well, what'd you find now, Doug? My deeper underlying cause and condition. Well, let's hear that. I said, hair. Your hair? Why don't we cut your hair off and see if you can stay sober? Not my hair. Remember, I told you I was a big star and traveled around the country. Oh, yeah. I forgot about the big star deal. Yeah. he said... Well, but you were loaded when you auditioned for that show. I told him too much. And I said, yeah. And he said, let me tell you something. Most non-alcoholic people, when they go to interview for a job they really want, won't take a drug they can't identify. That's clear. I get it. Okay, then I don't know what my deeper underlying cause is. And he said, don't worry about it. I said, yeah, maybe I'll get drunk. And he said, you will. You will get drunk if you swallow alcohol. So don't swallow any alcohol and go to a meeting tomorrow. Call me tomorrow. And I want you to start reading that book tomorrow. Read the book? Yeah, I want you to start reading the big book every day. Every day? You say, yeah, if you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. What incredibly great advice that was. I still do that to this day. I tell guys that I work with that. Read the book every day. If you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. And if you stick around here and don't drink and go to meetings and read the book every day, eventually you'll start doing what the book tells you to do. You know. Especially if your sponsor said, how's that third step going? You know? And you can find out if they're reading the book. So I'm very grateful to Jim Sass, my first sponsor, for telling me if you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. One of the greatest things. And I never did find my deeper underlying cause and condition. I don't know. I finally settled on trauma from circumcision. You know, it's... Who knows? I'll tell you what, I'm having fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a lot of fun in AA. I have a lot of great friends in AA. And I know that I have friends here tonight. My friend Patrick is going to talk tomorrow. And my friend Howard is going to talk Sunday. And Tammy's going to talk Sunday. And Ann is going to be our speaker tomorrow night. And Mitzi and Charlie are going to do the Al-Anon thing tomorrow. If you haven't heard them, they're great. So I'm excited about being here. And if you're new and you're wondering, what the hell is this guy talking about the music of Alcoholics Anonymous? It's the laughter. I think it's the laughter, you know. If you share to laugh with us tonight, you are in the band. You're part of the music. Thanks for letting me share with you.
hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.